this is where we start our Aging Well Together show. So excited for everyone to be back. We are, this could be our very last show. It's unclear if this is our last show, not forever, but our last show. I got Alicia a little like, what? This could be our last show in our studio. We're not sure if we're moving next week. I hear the move is next Saturday, so we may be coming to you live next Thursday, but it's unclear. But we are here in now our very hot studio. So excited, and I'm so excited for today's show. I always say that because I am always excited, but for different reasons. I have been a terrible host and planner for Aging Well Together because my longtime friend and colleague, Jonathan Williams from Clarity Legal, is here, and he doesn't know this, but over 2 years ago when we were planning, it's just 2 years ago, Janice and Tyler and I were talking about how we were doing the planning for this show in March of 2023, and I made my first list of guests I definitely wanted to have on the show right away, and Jonathan was on that list, and it has taken 73 shows and 2 years. That's my fault. Let's blame him, but it's really my fault for scheduling. Yeah, he's giving me the... So Jonathan is here from Clarity Legal. We are going to pummel him with questions, but he's going to do some overview on estate planning. And then I have all kinds of questions. Alicia, I know you will too, about guardianship and Medicaid and probate and all kinds of things that go into thoughtful planning. I am so thrilled for all we are going to learn together. But as always, before we dive into our show, we want to give a shout out to our friends and colleagues with WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carrboro for hosting our weekly Aging Well Together show in one of our last shows in our current location before we come to you from our new studio in the Drakeford Library. I'm going to miss this quirky space. We're getting bougie. We're going a little posh. We're getting a fancier studio. But thank you, WCOM. You listeners, you can catch us live every Thursday from 2 to 3 on 103.5 FM. And then thank you to those of us who are catching us live through a streaming, through a computer device or a phone device. WCOMFM.org is how you can stream us. The Aging Well Together show is brought to you by the always helpful team at the Orange County Department on Aging. I was with a group of them yesterday doing some fun planning. We'll be cryptic for fun radio planning for the future. Thrilled about that. They are amazing besides being our sponsors for the show and expert guests on the show. And depending on where we are, recording from over the next few weeks. Next three shows are OCDOA, Orange County Department on Aging staff, because it is Social Work Appreciation Month, Social Work Month. I am going to an event right after this in March. I am not a social worker, but I'm going to a Manny's and Margaritas event that my group is helping to sponsor to say thank you to social workers. So we're hoping to have the social work team on next week.
Manny's and Margaritas?
Yeah, manicures and margaritas. Sounds
manicures
pretty fun.
And margaritas?
Yeah, you drink. Okay.
Okay.
We have too much to get into. Okay. We'll watch our tangents. I don't know if I warned Jonathan. I may have. Anyway, so it is Social Work Appreciation Month and Women's History Month. Mm-hmm. And next month it's OT, Occupational Therapy Month. And so we're going to have that group on. But anyway, thank you so much, Orange County Department on Aging. Go to their website. If you do, you can catch up on any of our past shows, AKA our podcast. Thank you, Marilyn, for putting them all up. You can find our last 72 shows, and soon you'll be able to hear this show as well. On the website, you can also find a range of local Orange County aging resources. It's amazing. So go to the Orange County website, which is, this is where I slow down because everyone's grabbing paper and pencils, www.orangecountync.gov/aging. Remember, www.orangecountync.gov/aging. If you have questions about local resources, you can also call the Orange County Department on Aging at 919-968-2070. And if you have any question about our shows or want to email me about future topic ideas, please email me at one long word, agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com, agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com. Yes, I like to repeat. A shout out to the Carrboro-based band, the Robert Bradford Quartet. You heard just a few seconds of their original music, Mayfly, at the end of the show. You'll hear a lot more. And so thank you, Robert Bradford, and your quartet, sometimes a quintet, for letting us use their music. And as always, thank you, Alicia, my fabulous co-host, the extraordinary, motivating, wonderful, beautiful, inspiring, one of the wellness instructors with the Orange County Department on Aging. Yeah, she does. She pays me so much. And also the host of the show that comes on right after this, Afternoon Talk with Alicia, and an amazing community volunteer, does everything. I don't know if this show, Jonathan's going to get you to volunteer. About something, but she's already on the nursing home and the adult care home advisory board, which I could see be some link. All right.
Stop it. Stop there.
Now for me. I'm Heather Altman. Yes. I've spent over 25 years working in aging services and supports. I help older adults and their families connect with resources in our community. I'm a caregiver for older family members, and everyone is used to me saying this for our loyal listeners. And at 54, I am super invested in how we are all aging well together. Okay, let us dive in to today's program. Welcome again to my longtime colleague, Jonathan Williams. I did a little stalking. I told him, Oh, wait, I got it. Hold on. Wait. Okay, I pressed the wrong button. Jonathan, we have a new sound machine, and we just have so much giggles over it. Okay, I stalked Jonathan, went on the website. I told him I have a little stuff to say about him. Jonathan, because he's so humble, and so I want to praise him for all this. Jonathan is one of the original attorneys at Clarity Legal Group, and he is co-author of The Ultimate Caregiver Guide, How to Provide the Best Possible Care for Loved Ones and Yourself in North Carolina. I have a copy of that great book. It's wonderful. He is an elder law and estate planning attorney. Jonathan enjoys educating his clients about the law so they can gain peace of mind, knowing that their planning today will reduce future burdens of time, effort, and expense on their families. Jonathan has worked with hundreds of North Carolinians and their families, helping manage legacies through estate planning, long-term care planning, including Medicaid and veterans benefits, special needs planning, estate and trust administration, tax planning, guardianship, and more. There's just so much, and there's more that I didn't even put in that introduction. Welcome, Jonathan.
Welcome, Jonathan. Thank you.
He is so looking at
I'm
us like,
I'm so glad to be here. And thank you for your kind words about wanting to invite me. I'm glad to finally be here.
I know. And he's like, what have I gotten myself into? All right. And I've warned him because Jonathan and I have shared clients. And also, I will just call and email Jonathan with questions. He will do the same with me. And I already know that I have a bunch of questions that I want to ask him. But before we do that, we always like to know about our guests, and I know a little bit about Jonathan, and I really want him to share your background, your motivations. How did you get into helping in this whole legal thing? But I know you've done some really interesting educational work, so I'd like you to start from the beginning.
Well, I grew up in South Carolina. My dad was a Lutheran pastor, and so I lived in several towns around South Carolina growing up. The place I lived the longest is called Newberry, which is a little town in the Piedmont. It's got a Lutheran college, and so that was sort of my hometown, you might say. And then when I went to college, I went to Wake Forest University, and my undergraduate was in math and physics, so I sort of had the math and science talent and sort of bug when I was a kid. And then as I got further into my undergraduate studies, I found I was more interested in people than I previously thought. And what was really eye-opening for me was I went to London. I studied abroad in London. Wake Forest has this great study abroad program. And in order to make it work, I had to go with a humanities professor, and we studied art and theater and history, and just the idea that you could study what's important to people and how they tick and what they like and how they live just sort of blew my mind a little bit, because I always thought school was about
math and science.
Yeah, solving the question and getting the right answer, and all this sort of new world opened up for me. And so after college, I went back to Wake Forest a couple of years later studying religion. And I think that was related to my dad's work as a pastor, and I grew up going to church camp and things. I didn't want to become a pastor, but I did have an interest in sort of how religion plays a function in people's lives and what's important to them, and sort of, again, kind of how people tick and how they live together. And I again sort of found myself thinking, this is I want to be more in the world with people.
With yes. Health,
you know, the humanities was interesting, but it gets really heady really quickly, and I wanted to get in more into the real world, and so I was in a class. It was a religious ethics class, and we were reading some professional ethics as a component of that, and I read a little thing on legal ethics, and for the first time in my whole life, I thought, oh, this is something I could do. This is something that really could make a difference in people's lives. I always thought that being a lawyer was for a different kind of person from me, you know, the sort of stereotypical TV guy who likes to
yeah.
to talk a lot and argue a lot and is sort of headstrong. And
we were talking right before about vibes, and yeah. different attorneys give off different vibes, mm-hmm. and Jonathan gives off a great vibe, but it is
a different one.
Chill, yeah. more supportive. It's not that aggressive or right. adversarial, but go on. Sorry.
Yeah, so I never pictured myself doing anything like law. But reading that ethics, I thought, oh, you know, you could do some really good work with that. And so literally the next day, the professor, the ethics professor, who also himself had a law degree, mentioned in class that this program he'd been developing, which was a dual degree program between the Department of Religion, which is now the Department of Religious Studies, mm-hmm. and the law school, was given the green light by whatever board of trustees that had to approve it. And so he said, so if anybody's interested in getting into this program, you get a law degree and you get your master's.
I mean,
let me know if you're interested. And I just sort of thought that's
yeah,
one of those sort of
I could do that.
Bolt from the blue where it's like, okay, that's wow. a weird coincidence. And yes, I'm interested. And so that's sort of how I got into the law.
Love that about you, because it is such an interesting combination of the technical aspects that come from that part of your brain that I don't have, but other people have, math and science and or math and physics, and this is like the tale of my two daughters. I have an engineering daughter and one in the humanities and art history, and I'm trying to help them. When I saw your bio, I was like, oh gosh, I should have texted you. My daughter needed homework. But it really is just a great coming together of the thoughtfulness and the technical details or the specificity, but also that understanding how people tick. Okay, I'm going to have you just keep talking, but but within law, so how did then you transition to elder law and estate? Because that's a very specific kind of law.
Right. Well, given my background, you won't be surprised to learn that, you know, whereas many people go to law school because they want to get into litigation and they want to help, you know, people win cases and big settlements and things like that, I wasn't really motivated by that. I didn't think of myself as going and doing corporate law or corporate litigation or mm-hmm. even any sort of business work or business litigation. I just wasn't all that interested.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that are good at that, and that's great, and that
not your vibe.
Didn't feel like me. So I wanted to do something that was more involved with people's personal lives, you know, not necessarily their business lives. And so one of the things I thought about was family law.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for a summer during law school with a family law attorney. And that's really meaningful work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're helping somebody in a really tough spot in their life, and they need a lot of good guidance and they need good advocacy. But
it's intense.
It's very
right.
intense.
Divorces
and, very
and custody. Yeah, I was going to say that's still kind of adversarial.
Yeah, it was very adversarial. And that really, again, a good, really valuable work. There are great people that do it, and it takes a lot of compassion, but it just wasn't quite the right fit for me. You know, I liked that it was really impacting people's personal lives and in a really vulnerable and intense part of their lives,
mm-hmm.
but I just didn't like. I didn't like fighting.
Yeah.
And so elder law was sort of a great segue, because similar vibe, you're helping people in their personal lives at a particularly vulnerable part of their lives, you know, death and incapacity and,
mm-hmm.
and the family legacy and who's going to take care of things and who's going to get what and all that. You know, it's a similar vibe of you know, touching people in a really critical time of their lives. But the job is, I want to help you make this easy. I want to help you reduce the potential for conflict.
Yes.
I'm not here for you to fight with somebody.
Right.
I'm here to head all those things off. I don't want to help you go to court. I want to help you avoid going to court.
Yes.
and so it really hit. And Wake Forest, where I went to law school, had no longer has, sadly, but had a wonderful elder law clinic. The clinical professor had been there since the beginning, and she was very, very well respected in the national and in the statewide scene. So she was a really good mentor for me at the time, and sort of helped plug me into the elder law community in North Carolina, which is really collegial, mm-hmm. very good people. I mean,
good to hear. It's
folks that are here to help people, right. and aren't cutthroat and mm-hmm. Competitive. And there's more work out there.
There's a lot of people aging, a lot of boomers, mm-hmm. and you've got all the generations. You've got, especially, mm-hmm. I was in a meeting earlier this morning with one of your colleagues from your office, talking about how those of us in our 50s are really in that, we're planning for ourselves, we're planning for our parents, of course, planning for our children. So there's a lot going mm-hmm. on there. So you've got all the generations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there's no loss in clients or potential clients or people who need this help and guidance.
That's right. And so earlier today, you know, we've got a tricky situation in our office that we haven't encountered before. And so I just emailed a couple of Ooh. Elder law attorneys in other parts of the state saying, hey, have you guys ever encountered a situation like this? Do you have any guidance on this? And I know that they'll be willing to lend their help. So
do you want to ask me? Because you and I have talked about this, but I've watched a lot of law shows. And so I just like I pretend to be a medical doctor, I'm an academic doctor, not a medical one. Oh, I love playing lawyer. In fact, I'm a notary, so I was notarizing documents earlier today. So you need my advice on it? Because I'm, you know, really, or you'll tell me afterwards.
I'll tell you afterwards.
That's a good one. All right, so we'll get into the issues that I know we have. So in terms of that help and that guidance, before we get into some real specific, sticky kind of issues, or the ones that you try to make that so they're not sticky, what do you talk about when you do, oh wait, I forgot what we have to do. I told Jonathan we're gonna do this. All right, we've done this before, listeners. Because we're about to give some educational information, not giving advice, we're not giving guidance, it is time for our Aging Well Together disclaimer.
There you go.
All right. So wait, right before we now get into the specific work, we do want to add a fun disclaimer that we have for our legal and financial advisors, guests when they come on. So listeners, the information expressed today does not take into account your specific situation or objectives, and therefore it is not intended as recommendations for any specific individual. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from a qualified legal or tax or financial advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. The moral of the story is please do not sue WCOM or Clarity or Orange County Department on Aging because of something you heard. We are trying to be educational and entertaining. Attorney friend, how was that for a disclaimer?
Pretty good.
Does that
Pretty
work?
Good. That's exactly what I would say. This is an educational event.
Okay. So from an educational standpoint, when you talk about estate planning, kind of go over the basics that, you know, whether they're in your office or at a cocktail party or at church, when you're like, hey, this is what you need to have. What do you tell them?
Well, it's less about what you need to have and more about what you want to achieve, what you want to have happen. And my favorite way of thinking about estate planning is, at its core, it's about what happens when you can't be in control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because people get incapacitated, not everybody, but many people get incapacitated before death. Mm-hmm. And of course, pretty much everybody goes through the process of death.
Pretty much.
So these things happen. There will be a time when you're not in charge anymore. And what tools are you going to put in place so that that's as easy as possible for you, that mm-hmm. you have... the highest likelihood that what you want to have happen is going to happen,
mm-hmm.
and that the people that you trust are in charge of taking care of things, and they have tools in place that are going to make that as easy as possible and as clear as possible what their job is in terms of what your wishes are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about planning for when you're not in charge. And so, you know, yes, a will is important. Yes, a power of attorney is important. Yes, healthcare directors are important. But the core is, what tools do we need? Because one of the things that can trip people up, particularly thinking about what happens at death, you know, they, well, I need a will for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the only way assets pass at death. There's all sorts of things that can happen. We've got rights of survivorship. We've got beneficiary designations. You might have a life estate deed on your real estate. You know, there's all sorts of ways how property can pass at death, and the will is not always the right answer. So one of the sort of brain teasers we like to throw out there to folks is just the notion that you can have a will and you can know exactly what it says, but you don't necessarily know what it does because you don't know what it applies to unless you're careful about how your assets are owned, how your assets are organized. You know, if I have a life insurance policy and I name my spouse as beneficiary on that policy, and then I get divorced and I change my will and I say, well, now everything's going to my kids. It's not going to my
spouse. But you don't change, I keep hearing that, but you don't change that.
If you don't change the beneficiary designation, guess what happens? It's not the will that controls it. And so, you know, we want to think more holistically than just what kind of documents you have. It's a more holistic picture than that. How you got things organized and what tools are in play.
And what I like about that, and if it's okay, because I like to pretend I'm a lawyer, but I do a lot of education on advanced care planning, and I experienced this in my own life. Sometimes that when you're not in control, that can be a temporary thing. So my dad, as he hung out in the spa, and we've had him on the show, we'll have him on again, when he hung out at the spa at the ICU for a few weeks. So I was, the things got put in because he was not able to be in control for a few weeks. So that's where the healthcare power of attorney and the durable power of attorney came in. However, as soon as he was awake and capable of making his own decisions, then it came on. So it doesn't, and sometimes people don't realize it. They just think, oh, when I'm permanently or something happens. But they don't realize that can even be like a unexpected hospitalization where someone is not conscious and can't speak for themselves. How's that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, he's so supportive.
Yeah, and you know, you can be under anesthesia for, you know, 3 hours and there might be some decision that needs to be made. We have got an intern in our office that had she injured her knee and they're not quite sure what things are going to look like until they get in there because they have to they have to repair one ligament, but there might be a decision that needs to be made and she might be under anesthesia at that time. Who's going to be making that decision for her when she's not awake and available to make that decision? And
so, it is a full-time job being a healthcare power of attorney when your loved one is in the hospital and needs lots of surgeries.
But if that happens,
you have to sign off on three. Yeah.
And then if that does happen, and
you want to name
does the doctor, I mean, I guess the average person would say the doctor will make the decision.
So there's a statute that says if you're not able to make your own medical decisions, here's the hierarchy of people who have the authority to make that decision for you. It's not your doctor. It starts with court-appointed guardian.
But
most people don't have a court-appointed guardian.
But what if you need it now?
That's right. So if there's not a guardian in place, then the next person would be the duly appointed healthcare agent under a healthcare power of attorney. Not everybody has a healthcare power of attorney either.
You need it now.
And so then we go on down the list. So spouse would be next. If your spouse is there, they make the decision. If you don't have a spouse, we go to the next person, which I think, again, this is an educational event. I think it's adult children first.
Okay, because I was like, when did the parents?
I think it's children.
And then parents. And then I think siblings.
But all
I don't know the statute.
Going on in the emergency.
This is different. No, this is different than an emergency. I think
I
know where Alicia's going.
Like,
in an emergency situation, the doctors are going to save your life and do stuff. But
absolutely.
They have a moment and decisions need to be made.
You're going down that.
That other people can
weigh in
on.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Obviously, in an emergency situation, they've got the Hippocratic Oath, and they've got to do what they can to stabilize.
But if you're under and you just have to have a decision made.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it can be temporary in nature. And again, if you want to take control over who's in charge of these decisions, rather than leaving it up to the hierarchy that our state legislature put in place, you can say, no, I don't want it to be my spouse, or I don't want it to be my kids. I want it to be this person. Mm-hmm. You make a healthcare power of attorney and you say so.
Yep. All right. And I could just, I'm so trying hard not to tangent us because there's so many stories just about that because I can tell you lots and you could tell even more. So you tell people kind of think about, the first process is thinking about what you would want and what you would like to achieve when you're, and what you want people to know if you're not in control, if you're not able to speak for yourself. And then it comes to the conversations, then at some point documents get put in play. So anything else about basic estate planning that before we start pummeling you with other things?
Sure. Yeah, I do want to get across the concept of avoiding probate and avoiding guardianship.
Oh, please do that.
And I know
we failed.
I know that you want to talk in more detail about guardianship, and I'm happy to do that. But in general, I'll say that guardianship is a court process whereby a court may decide that you are unable to manage your own affairs. That's called incompetency, and that a legal guardian needs to be placed over you. And so if you become incapacitated and there is no healthcare power of attorney in place, there is no durable power of attorney in place, and decisions need to be made over the long term, not a short-term thing, but over the long term, then someone who cares about you may have to take you to court and have you declared incompetent and either become your guardian or request that the court appoint somebody as your guardian. Mm-hmm. And that is an expensive undertaking. You've got to pay court fees. You may have to pay lawyer fees. And I got to say, lawyers are sometimes expensive.
So, yep.
I didn't think about the payment.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it takes some time. It takes several weeks to get this in place. And who the guardian will be is entirely in the discretion of the clerk of court. Mm. You know, they're probably going to appoint someone close to you who you have some trust in. But ultimately, that's the court's decision. And guardianship can be avoided so easily through mechanisms like a general power of attorney or a living trust. If you've given someone else the authority to step in and act for you when you're incapacitated through a tool like a power of attorney or a living trust, then that person has the authority to take care of things. There's no need to take you to court and have a guardian put in place. And so you can save yourself sort of the heartache and hassle of going through it. Mm-hmm. You can save your family the heartache and hassle and expense of going through it, and make everybody's life a little easier by avoiding guardianship.
So can I ask my questions? I'm going to
Absolutely.
About guardianship. So there are a few situations that I have seen where guardianship was done or is being considered. And first of all, I know it is ultimately up to the court, but people can put their own ideas of who they'd like to be a guardian, because I see that in some of these documents. I just notarized a document this morning. I've seen it in my own families, where when you're in your healthcare power of attorney or in your durable power of attorney, there's a section that says, if guardianship is needed, I want this person. Mm-hmm. So if I have this right, ultimately the court has to bless it. But you can put your wish known, like, if I need a guardian, this is who I want it to
be. Right. But if you're doing those documents, the likelihood that you'll ever need a guardianship is pretty low.
True.
But yes, part of that document is to nominate your own potential guardian.
Guardian. Yeah. And the situation that I heard of, a gentleman was a guardian for a family member, and it was required... the police actually required that there's guardianship, because when you're working with someone who was questioning their competency, like, hey, I don't need to be here, and they were living in a place and saying they're keeping me here against my will, you know, things like that, that's where they said you're going to want to have an official guardianship, because the police, like, were called, and this was the situation where they were like, you need to have, the family member needs to be a legal guardian and go through the process, because otherwise, is someone being,
That's the difference between the guardianship and just the general estate planning documents.
Yes.
In that, if I make a power of attorney saying I want my spouse to be able to act for me like I can act for me, just because I've given my spouse the power to, you know, write checks on my account or sign my name to a deed or something like that, doesn't mean I can't still do that for myself. But a guardianship does mean that. A guardianship means I'm incompetent. My guardian does things for me. I don't do them for myself anymore. And so sometimes, even though you've done the proper planning, we've got to do a guardianship anyway, because the person is acting in a way that is self-destructive to themselves. So if the nature of my incapacity is that now every time I watch TV and I see a commercial and somebody's asking for money for this charity or this ministry or this whatever, and I just start writing checks and indiscriminately, and it's harming my well-being. Just because I've signed a power of attorney doesn't mean my checks won't still be honored. They'll still be honored.
Yes.
It's when I'm under a guardianship that my guardian is now writing the checks and I can't write them anymore. And so sometimes even when you do the proper planning, we still need a guardianship. The other situation where you might still need a guardianship is if you name somebody on the power of attorney, but that person is acting improperly or not acting at all.
How could you prove that?
If you haven't...
Somebody else would have to step in.
Somebody else could step in.
A professional or another family member saying, this person is taking advantage of that.
Interesting.
It's got to be proven.
It'd have to be proven in
court.
That's why the courts get involved.
Yeah,
that's right.
And there's been... I mean, it's back in the news this week with the Wendy Williams, and we saw it with Britney Spears. So there's been some really controversial, because some questions about, are they really in... But I have seen it in situations where, it's painful, but that they really did need to go. I have someone looking into it in case, again, the loved one doesn't agree because of cognitive issues that they need the support. And so they were concerned they would need the next level of guardianship to help bring in the support or have them live somewhere.
Right. How is that brought up? I mean, who brings that to your attention that this person needs a guardianship?
It can happen in a lot of different ways. Sometimes the family knows, sometimes the family doesn't know, sometimes it's the neighbor that finds out. Sometimes in the example Heather gave, it's the police that get called.
The police were super supportive, but they're like, look, your family member's calling us saying, I'm not supposed to be here. We need to get involved unless you can actually be the guardian.
Okay. So by that time, you know it to be
true. And sometimes it's Adult Protective Services.
Like the Department of Aging.
Department of Social Services.
Department on Aging will make a referral over to APS. I've suggested that before when people have called and said, this person is in the community and is really struggling, and there's no family, there's no one to support, and so they're going to need a court-appointed guardian to support.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know I've had these questions, and I've talked to Jonathan about it clearly on the air and then off the air. Is this common, or I don't want to spend too much time talking about a weird exception. It's just strange. It's come up a few times recently.
Is guardianship common?
Yeah.
I don't think it's particularly common.
It's just been me in the last few months.
Good. I was thinking good, because it's my day.
You know. The way I sometimes will explain it is, you know, this is the concept of how guardianship work. It goes back hundreds and hundreds of years in English common law. I mean, it's sort of the traditional way the law deals with it. Court gets involved, you're incompetent, here's the guardian. The idea that we might use powers of attorney or trusts or healthcare directives
to avoid
the need for it is a much more recent development in the law. I mean, still, you know, a good 100 years old or so, but it's a more recent development. But if you have the ability to do some estate planning, get these tools in place so that the people you trust have the legal authority to make medical decisions for you, to make financial decisions for you, to write checks for you, to pay your bills for you, all these things, then the likelihood that you'll need to be subjected to a guardianship proceeding and all the cost and hassle and heartache that involves goes way down. It doesn't completely eliminate it for the reasons we've talked about, but it makes it much less likely.
So then let's continue on with our list of things people would like to avoid.
Yes.
So they want to avoid guardianship. You use the word, which I have learned that I use wrong in the sentence, probate. Like, I use it, I don't know how I use it. Like, I was just like, you don't want to go into probate, or what is probate? And I remember one time people were like, no, probate is like, explain probate and how it should be used in a
should it be
sentence.
Avoided or it,
yeah, or is that just the process? Pushed. I don't know.
So probate sort of gets used colloquially to mean estate administration under the court's supervision.
Okay.
If you want the technical definition,
that's pretty thoughtful. Right. Okay.
Probate just means to prove. It comes from the Latin word to prove.
Oh, okay.
And what it refers to is probating a will, to prove a will, right? To get the court to acknowledge that it's the legitimate will that governs this person's estate. So that's the root of the word.
I'm sorry. Is it because someone's contesting? It could be.
But you're required to prove the will whether or not it's contested. So
that's
why when you sign a will,
Isn't it like everyone? Is it like everyone goes through probate, but you don't want to go through probate? It was something like I was misusing. Because the process,
So most of the time when people say probate, they just mean the court process of administering an estate.
Okay.
And
it's going to happen?
No, it does not have to happen. Probate is necessary if there are assets in someone's name and they've died and nobody has the legal access to them and they need to go to a beneficiary. Then you go through probate to get it. So, for example, if I've got a retirement account, I've got a beneficiary designation on that retirement account. When I die, my beneficiary can make a claim on that through the custodian who manages that asset. Mm-hmm. And there's no court process that's needed for that, right? But if I've got a bank, and if I got a bank account with my wife, and we own it joint with right of survivorship. When I die, she's the owner. She doesn't have to go to court for that. But if it's an account just in my name, and there's no beneficiary, there's no joint owner, it's just in my name, then when I die, who's got the legal access to that account? Nobody. Because if I had a power of attorney, the power of attorney
no longer exists
after death. If there's a guardianship, the guardianship terminates at death as well.
What's weird is that the will doesn't kick in to say, "Will all my assets go to so and so?" That because this happened twice. We had to go into probate twice with my mom because an account was found, and like it was for like 40 years old, and somehow. But I don't understand why the will didn't just kick in then. Like,
The will does sort of kick in, so to speak, but a will is not self-executing, meaning. You can't just do what the will says. It's got to go through the court process. It's got to go through probate.
So the will helped to justify to the court why that money was supposed to go a certain place. But
yeah, that's right. So the probate has to happen, and the will's going to say who's entitled to inherit what and who's entitled to serve as the representative of the estate. That person, if they're named in the will, is called the executor. Mm-hmm. If there's some other mechanism that governs that asset, then we don't have to go to probate to make it happen. So if there's a right of survivorship, if there's a beneficiary designation, and I need to mention, if that account is in some kind of trust arrangement, right? If you've made a living trust and you've put your bank accounts in your living trust, then upon your death, the trust is self-executing. Okay. If you name a trustee of a trust that says, once I die, here's who I want my assets to go to, then the trustee has the legal authority to control that account, pay any debts and taxes that are owed by your estate at death, and then to get the remaining assets to the beneficiaries in a self-executing way, meaning we don't have to go to court to make this happen.
Right. But
the will, anything that's happening under the will has to happen through the court-supervised process. You got to go to probate court to make that happen.
Something in the will wasn't clearly distinguished through, like, beneficiaries already. Okay. All I know is had to do it with my mom, and then had to do it again. And I think I spoke to you about it. We found some bonds in my grandmother's name that my mother was. I mean, bonds like from the, you know, it was actually, they weren't that old. They were from the 80s or 70s when bonds were in. And so my grandmother had passed away. My mother had passed away, but it was not worth that much money. And so to pay attorneys, I told my dad, we're not bringing attorneys back into this. And I went to Orange County, the courthouse, the Register of Deeds. Who is it that helped me?
The probate court in North Carolina is the clerk of court.
The
clerk of court. So you go to the clerk's office for this.
And they had to open the estate. And they're like, all right, we'll open the estate for like 48 hours, which gives you enough time to take it, run to the bank, get a receipt, go back, and then we'll close the estate. Because it was just a small amount of money. It was like $1,000. And I'm like, if I bring in an attorney, it'll cost more than that.
Yeah, the law does allow the clerk to open and close an estate themselves if it's lower than $5,000.
And it was. So that's why. And I think I got advice from you. I think I was like, what do I do with this? I don't want... So, all right. So, but everyone's goal then is they want to avoid guardianship and they want to avoid probate. And that's why they work with you and say, how can we, is it like, let's designate everything so it's so clear that they can use your term self-execute as opposed to bringing the courts in. Was that a good summary?
Yeah. So we do think very carefully about probate avoidance when we're doing estate planning, just because, again, probate, it's a lot like guardianship, except it's for a person who's died rather than somebody who's alive. But in both cases, we've got a court process that takes a long time, that costs a lot of money, is a lot of hassle, and can be easily avoided. And so we think carefully about that. And for assets that ordinarily would be subject to probate, assets like investments and bank accounts and things like that, we very often use a living trust as a vehicle to hold those assets and then to have them pass at death to the named beneficiaries under that trust agreement. And then there are some assets that we don't put in the trust because we just rely on the beneficiary designations.
Like life insurance policies?
Like life insurance and retirement accounts primarily.
Okay. Oh, I'm so torn because I know I want to get into Medicaid. So there, I'm thinking of big words like revocable and irrevocable. Should we just leave it as like, that's why you talk to, if you have an if you have enough stuff where there's some complication, you do want to get some legal advice. And even this word trust is a very complicated thing, how to set them up.
And just for the record, for your audience, we're talking about a revocable trust here.
Okay.
That's a trust you can control while you're alive.
That you can revoke it. That's why it's called revocable.
You can change it. You can, you know, adjust the plan anytime you wish because it's your trust. And importantly, you can use and control the assets any way you like. You name yourself as trustee typically. So you create a trust and you put assets in it, but you're still in control.
Yes.
But the trick is when you pass away, you've got a successor ready to take over for you, and they just pick it up and go. So they've got the authority to take control of those assets, pay the bills and taxes that need to be paid, and get the assets to the beneficiaries.
And that's hard for people. I see it in my own world. I see it with my clients are finding those folks that they trust to support their trust. They're literally trust. And so do you serve as that for people?
We're not the default by any means. Typically people are naming, of course, themselves as trustees of these things, and then a spouse or adult children most commonly.
Yes.
But certainly we have seen situations where people aren't married, or they don't, or their spouse doesn't have the ability to do this,
or their children are younger. So I had to do that, and then you have the like, well, who will do it, and then at what age, and is even though they're 21, so it gets basically the stuff can get super complicated, and that is with folks that generally have any number of assets. What I want to do is talk about Medicaid because and. Medicaid's been all over the news this week and all over my work discussions because there's a lot of concern about how to protect Medicaid. But specifically when it comes to Medicaid for long-term care and as estate planning is the wrong term, but as a planning tool, because I know I'm working with a number of folks who have limitations on their funds or their family members do, and they're trying to figure out how to pay the expense of long-term care, so nursing home and assisted living costs, or even in-home care. And they're wondering, well, they don't have any money, or they don't seem to have a lot of money. Can Medicaid kick in? And I get that question often, and then I'm like sending them to DSS and to you. So, and others. How do you describe Medicaid when it comes to long-term care or thinking through it?
Yeah, so there are couple of dozen at least Medicaid programs. And so just to be clear to those who are listening, we're not talking about Medicaid generally. We're talking about a couple of specific programs. One is long-term care Medicaid. Long-term care Medicaid covers intermediate and skilled care in a skilled facility like a nursing home, essentially. So if you're at a skilled level of need and you're in a nursing home, Medicaid could be available to help pay for that care if you qualify financially. There is also a benefit program that helps people pay for care in an assisted living facility, including most memory care units, which are based out of assisted living facilities. That's a state-based program called State County Special Assistance. We usually just call it Special Assistance. There are some Medicaid dollars that can support people on special assistance. That's a different Medicaid program called Personal Care Services. And you will often hear assisted living people talk about whether they accept Medicaid or not.
Yes.
But that's not the long-term care Medicaid benefit. That's the special assistance with the personal care services.
I did not realize,
Medicaid.
And that was so helpful right before we went on air. And because I work with a lot of assisted living places, and some of them, there's just a few that in our area that take Medicaid. So what they're really taking is the Medicaid personal care assistance.
But what you apply for is special assistance.
Okay.
And the PCS, the personal care services Medicaid, kind of comes along under the radar, but
okay,
along with that.
And that can also provide support at home, right? It doesn't, or is that special assistance for,
there is
a different?
There is a personal care services Medicaid component that can be taken advantage of at home. I want to sort of name my boundaries here. I don't work a lot with that.
Okay.
I'm focused on the long-term care.
We like boundaries.
Medicaid.
We mess them up all the time, and we blur them, but we respect them, kind of. All right, so that's helpful. And again, this is, and so selfish of me, but I was like, hey, I have you on the air. But it's amazing how many people, or just assume, and that's where sometimes it's sort of complicated, because they will call DSS and realize while they think their loved ones aren't bringing in a lot of money because of their Social Security amount, and if you know any of the numbers, that'd be great if you can share it. They're often very surprised to find out that they might not be eligible.
Right. Yeah, the biggest impediment for folks getting special assistance is the income cap. It does have an income cap that can be surprisingly low.
Yeah.
And I should have boned up on this before I came
and
in.
Don't listen.
It's in the neighborhood of $1,300 or $1,400 a month.
That's what I was going to say. I thought it might be a little bit higher, like something. But it's like $1,400 a month, and it's amazing.
It's
how many
higher
people.
for special care units, with like the memory care unit.
Oh, okay.
It's more like $1,900 or so.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Again, I'm so sorry. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head.
But people are surprised because they're like, oh, my mom's bringing in $1,800 from Social Security. That's all she has. She doesn't have any. And it's like, but.
And it's a real shame because $1,800 a month will not pay for assisted living care.
Mm-mm. No.
I mean, it's like three times, four times that amount now. And yet, if you're, a dollar over the asset limit, I'm sorry, the income limit, you just won't qualify.
Mm-hmm. And people are devastated by that.
Yeah, and if it's Social Security income, you're not going to make that go away. You know, you can't just say, I would like to decline some of my income. Like, they're going to pay you what you're entitled to be paid. Now, if what puts you over the limit is like some kind of private pension that you get from your company, you might be able to convert a private pension into like a lump sum, and now you don't have it as income. You're going to have a different problem on your hands in that you've got a sum of money that's preventing you from getting on the benefit, but that can be dealt with, whereas being over the income limit can't really be dealt with.
And this is, just to clarify, this was for the assisted living level under on the skilled nursing. When it actually comes to long-term care, that's where, and you're seeing a lot of stats go on, and I saw it too and didn't bring it, and I don't want to look. It's something, 60 to 70% of all of our nursing home care is actually paid by Medicaid.
Yes.
And so because,
and that does not have the same income cap. So
exactly,
yeah, we should
and
be
that's
real
where
clear
people,
about that.
Yes, and that, because I want to use the term that we hear a lot, which is the spend down and how do I become eligible, and the clarification is that's for nursing home care.
That's right.
And people mix them up, not assisted living. But so how does that look for people? Because that's not income based.
Right.
Kind of.
Well,
it is.
Let's talk about the income component first. If you're in a nursing home and you're on Medicaid, the way it works is you have an obligation to pay from your income to the facility. And that amount is called your patient monthly liability. So if I have $1,800 a month in income and I'm in a nursing home, I get to deduct the cost of my medical insurance premiums, right? So that I can still pay for my Medicare Part B, my Medicare Part D, my Medicare supplement, things like that. And I get a whopping $70 monthly allowance.
Which they just raised.
It was 30 forever.
For years. Wow. Yeah. Can you imagine living on $30 to buy shampoo or books or go out for
or
a meal or buy
done.
A present? Yeah, everyone gets your hair. You can't even get your hair done. All right, so you have so they take all of it minus 70.
But the rest of your income you have to pay to the facility, to the nursing home. And then only after you've paid your share does Medicaid calculate sort of what they owe. So they sort of pick up the slack. Okay. You pay what you can, Medicaid pays the rest, is sort of the way that works.
So if you're at a nursing home and they're charging, and it's somewhere between, you know, $10,000 and $15,000 a month, are these fair numbers to use?
Yeah.
So, because I know it can be high, 10 or 15, and you have through all your stuff, $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll pay the $5,000,
right?
And then Medicaid will pick up the other $5,000,
pick up the rest.
Or whatever their negotiated
whatever they
rate is.
Negotiate. That's right.
So how do you? Just also in the interest of time. So when people, do I just keep sending them to you and a DSS and to other attorneys? How do you work with people when they kind of to work through the assumption that you know, how do you start that conversation? Or do people come to you and say, "Hey, we're looking out 10 years"? For myself or for my parents,
mm-hmm.
and we're already anticipating mm-hmm. that there's going to be we're anticipating needs are going to be there,
mm-hmm.
and anticipating the money's not going to be there to cover mm-hmm. it. What do we do now? Do people come and ask you that, or?
Yeah. So, getting good advice on this is really valuable, and a good elder law attorney can be really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we think of it in the process of estate planning. And if you're thinking 10 years ahead, there are lots of things you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use some irrevocable trusts as a way to...
Here we go. We got that word in.
Plan for...
legal bingo. Okay.
Yeah. To plan for potential Medicaid eligibility. But it depends on the unique situation of each person,
right,
as to whether what steps are going to take if they're thinking about this. Sometimes it's nothing. Sometimes it's go talk to XYZ person I know who can help you figure out if long-term care insurance is an option.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so we are happy to have relationships with folks we can refer to.
And we had the wonderful Bill Comfort. He did a show.
I know Bill as
yes.
well.
Yes. And so I think the moral of the story, and we've had a few shows like this. We did have a whole show on veterans benefits. We've had shows on Social Security and financial advising and others. The moral of the story is you may need to get help for some of these things, that it's complex and each situation's unique.
Yeah. And the other thing to say is, if you're not thinking years in advance, and I got to say, most people don't. So most of the calls we get are so-and-so's in rehab. They're gonna be transitioning to long-term care. We need to get them eligible for Medicaid as quick as possible. Can you help? And the answer is almost always, yeah, we can help. Because there may be some things we can do to spend down assets. We can be creative about that. There are categories of assets that are non-countable. We may be able to take some assets that are countable and convert them into a non-countable version.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, if you're on Medicaid for long-term care and you pass away, Medicaid then has the right to be a creditor in your estate,
mm-hmm.
and potentially have assets subject to a recovery claim after death.
Mm.
And so part of good planning is minimizing your exposure to a claim by the creditor after death. And there's so you know, there's almost always something that can be done to improve the situation, either to protect assets from a recovery claim, hasten eligibility and get folks eligible as quick as we can, and protect as much as the law allows, because the law does have exemptions for all kinds. You know, you're allowed to purchase some life insurance. There are mm-hmm. Medicaid-compliant annuities, Medicaid-compliant
promises. Your spouse doesn't have to be
there are protections for the spouse. Yes, that's right. And so there's lots of things that can be done to make sure that you're putting yourself and your family in the best position you can.
Yeah.
And again, those things are really valuable.
And then it's a whole other show about, can you even find a place, though? It gets really complicated to find places that accept Medicaid and that work with the expectations people have. All right, in our 2 minutes left, we had a list of things to talk about. We've talked about them all except for special needs trusts and special needs planning. Is there anything you would like to say in 90 seconds that would sort of say what that is?
Sure. So special needs planning basically refers to people who may be on a need-based government benefit. So that might be Medicaid for long-term care. It might be Medicaid for adults who are disabled. Okay. It might be SSI for mm-hmm. adults who are disabled. And essentially, what you want to do in most cases is, if you've got a beneficiary in your plan who is on a government benefit, and you leave them an inheritance, now they may no longer be eligible for this mm-hmm. benefit. They're going to lose their benefit. They got to spend the money you left them, and then they go right back on the benefit, and they're kind of sort of in the same position that they started. Mm-hmm. And so a better way to do it is to create a special needs trust. And a special needs trust allows the assets to be there for the benefit of that beneficiary. It is not going to be a countable asset. It's not going to prevent them from retaining the benefits that they're already on. But instead, that money can be there to enhance the quality of life rather than just replace what they're getting already. So it can be there to pay for the TV subscription that helps to pay for the wheelchair accessible mm-hmm. van that Medicaid's not going to pay for, that mm-hmm. will pay for travel opportunities or educational expenses or all kinds of things over and above the basics. And so mm-hmm. putting some special needs planning in place can really put you in a position to improve the quality of life of the people that you care about rather than just sort of take them off their benefits for a few months.
Well, and I love watching you here, but I've gone to a number of your talks, and that, and even just planning in general, thinking about if you're gonna, you know, grandparents gonna leave money to the grandchildren, well, make sure you do it in such a way that it doesn't mess up their ability to get college loans and things like that. So there's all kinds of ways. I think planning is the moral of the story, thoughtfulness. If people would like to reach out to you, we don't promote businesses here, but people may want to reach out to you. How would they find you, Jonathan?
Well, we certainly have a website that has all our contact information on it. So the law firm is Clarity Legal Group. If you do a web search for that, especially if you add the word Triangle NC, you'll get us. But the website is claritylegalgroup.com, and our phone number is there. You can find my email address there. Yeah. And
your picture and your bio.
My picture, which I now refer to as what I used to look like.
I think because you have the beard now. I didn't pay attention to how it looked different. You and I both look very different than how we started, but we've went through different phases in the pandemic. Longer here. All right. We need to end the show. There's so much we want to get into. Jonathan, I am so happy to have you on. We cannot thank you enough. Jonathan Williams from Clarity Legal Group. And excited to have you come back. I want to do a whole show with you on ethics and different ethical or different complexities, or just when we start doing call-ins, maybe we'll mm-hmm. figure that out. We're just going to come up with all those questions, but we can't wait to have you back on the show.
That sounds wonderful.
Jonathan, thank you so much. Alicia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather.
WCOM, thank you so much for one of our last times, and it's very stormy looking outside, so I don't know. The world is crying because it could be one of our last one. Orange County Department on Aging, thank you for all your support. And as always, listeners, thank you. Stay safe, stay warm, stay cool, stay dry. And we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.